This is Medieval Death Trip for Wednesday, September 18th, 2024, episode 108, concerning the end of the interdict and a vexatious prophet. Hello and welcome to Medieval Death Trip, the show where we explore the wit and weirdness of medieval texts. I'm your host, Patrick Lane. This episode, we're picking up where we left off last time in the Melrose Chronicle, a text uniquely preserved in a 13th century manuscript. We stopped previously at the end of the year 1211, with England and its temperamental King John still under an interdict proclaimed by Pope Innocent III, sparked off by the king's refusal to accept the papally approved new Archbishop of Canterbury, Stephen Langton. The interdict forbid the celebration of Mass and the performance of most sacraments. Baptisms were still permitted, though with restrictions on attendance, and priests could still hear confession. But they would have had to make house calls to do so, as the churches were to be shut to the common people and with only limited admission of pilgrims. It's a bit unclear exactly how upsetting this would have been to the common people, since in the 13th century, commoners had rather limited access to the sacraments in the first place. The Eucharist was typically not administered to everyone at Mass. It was reserved for the people at the altar and on the front row, so to speak. And as we heard back in our Meyer-Helmbrecht series, for peasants, it was not uncommon for weddings to be primarily secular affairs. Lack of access to proper Christian burial, however, was likely a more pressing concern. Given the sheer number of bad outcomes stacking up on King John's resume in those years, it's hard to know just what proportion of the general atmosphere of discontent in England should be attributed to the interdict compared to other events. Last episode, we did see our chronicler portraying the anxious and unhappy state of the English people, though this didn't quite seem to touch John yet. But this time, we will see emerging out of that seething discontentment some distinct eruptions of voices confronting the king himself. But we start this section of the chronicle not with the king, but rather Pope Innocent III, as he sends out the call for what will be the Fourth Lateran Council. The council itself won't convene until a couple of years later in 1215. We won't get to the actual council in today's selection, but I wanted to highlight it for two reasons. The first relates to how our chronicler presents it, which is in terms of the strength of Innocent III's political/clerical machine. He has powerful and effective agents essentially embedded in the courts of Europe, and the summoning of all these leading lights to Rome creates a kind of narrative opportunity to visualize this network of operatives. The second point I want to make links back to the persecutions and crusades that featured last episode. Many of the canons or decrees that came from Lateran IV involve important church reforms, especially around reining in excesses and corruptions of the clergy. It prohibited clergy from participating in hunting and mandated appropriate dress codes for them. It prohibited the sons of clergy from inheriting their father's offices. And it forbid any cleric from pronouncing a death sentence in a trial and forbid them from even attending executions. So those are largely positives, I would say. But the same philosophy that leads to enforcing the pious purity of the clergy also leads to harsher responses to heretics and non-Christians. For example, Lateran IV decreed that Jews and Muslims must be specially marked and identified by their dress so that Christians might not have unknowing intercourse with them. And I use that word in its full range of meanings. The canon specifically calls out the hazard of Christian men having relations with Jewish and Muslim women, and Jewish and Muslim men having relations with Christian women, unknowingly. It also prohibits Jews from holding office and puts in place stronger punishments for, quote, oppressive and immoderate interest, end quote, on loans to Christians. So, while many of the canons of Lateran IV are lauded as important steps towards the institutionalization of canon law and regularization of its practice, it has also been identified as a key step in fostering a culture of persecution in Europe and its colonies that would continue to fester and expand throughout the next 800 years. And on the subject of the passage of time, if you follow up on any of the events or people mentioned in this history, you might notice some date discrepancies, usually things seeming to be off by a year. For example, we're hearing about the calling of Lateran IV in the entry for the year 1212 in the Melrose Chronicle, But if you go to the Wikipedia article on Lateran IV, it says that it was called in 1213. Well, this is due to the differences over what date marks the start of the new year between the Middle Ages and modern practice. You can learn more about that in our episode 21, A New Year's Chimera. As with our previous selection from the Melrose Chronicle, the more narrative chunks of today's text are framed by the basic historical accounting that monastic chronicles perform, recording deaths of significant figures and appointments to church offices. This provides us a nice opportunity to review another bit of medieval culture by briefly defining some of those church offices that are going to appear in today's text. So let's start right up at the top of the hierarchy and work our way down. Of course, at the top, and featuring throughout our selection, is the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, ostensibly the inheritor of St. Peter's apostolic jurisdiction as head of the church. The nature of that inheritance proves to be a bit more symbolic than historical, as there's little evidence of an actual bishopric in Rome before about the 3rd century. But we're going to go ahead and move down a rung in our ladder here, since we'll be talking more about the papacy in our next episode. So next we have cardinals. Cardinal is not so much an office in itself as it is a kind of membership in an honor society. The Pope selects leading clerics to become members of the College of Cardinals. Typically, these are bishops or archbishops, and indeed, special dispensation is required by canon law to elevate someone not consecrated as a bishop to the status of cardinal. And the cardinals remain bishops or archbishops or whatever title they held before. They are now just also cardinals. The chief responsibility of the College of Cardinals is to elect new popes, though individually, cardinals tend to function as counselors to and agents of the Pope wherever they are deployed. One such function could be to serve as a papal legate, an agent empowered to essentially negotiate and act as the Pope's proxy with other leaders, secular and religious. Legates come in different flavors. For example, one might be a legatus missus, a sent legate, who really is just empowered to accomplish a specific, limited mission. Missus, mission, the thing you're sent on, it's right there. Or one might be a legatus lettera, a legate from the side, i.e. from beside the Pope, a close associate invested with broad powers to act for the Pope wherever they go. And if you think there might be some etymological connection between the Pope sending agents a latere and the Lateran Council, you'd be showing good instincts, but you would be wrong. The council is named for the site where it is convened, the Lateran Palace, the primary residence of the Pope. I thought surely the Lateran Palace was named that because it stood beside St. Peter's Basilica or something. And that's wrong. They aren't particularly close. They're about 2.5 miles or 4.3 kilometers apart on opposite sides of the Tiber. Now, the Lateran Palace is adjacent to another basilica, that of St. John Lateran, the site, by the way, where you'll find the tomb of Gerbert d'Auriac, the alleged demon pope of a few episodes back. And the basilica is not notably beside anything either. The adjective Lateran in its name comes from the name of the original structures that stood on that site in ancient Rome, the Palace of the Laterani family. Exactly where the family name comes from doesn't seem to be known in any references I could find. It might be connected to a minor deity, Laternus, a god of the hearth whose name derives from one Latin word for brick or tile, later. But this deity only appears in a single text by a Christian writer mocking the plethora of minor Roman deities and household gods, so it may not have been a genuinely recognized deity. Anyway, that's just a lot to say that in our text, you will hear about the Pope sending out agents a latera to help convene a Lateran council, but there is no actual direct connection between those words. So, getting back to our hierarchy and taking a step out of the Roman Curia, we have our much larger collection of archbishops and bishops. I don't think I need to go into much detail here. The church has a kind of fractal hierarchy that repeats its structures at each level, and the bishops serve regionally the executive role that the Pope serves for the whole church. Adding a few more job titles to our list, bishops would have their own entourages, which might include a chancellor, a chief record keeper, and often institutional manager. Our text today also refers to a clericus de sigillo, or clerk of the seal, who would have been responsible for preparing official documents and serve as a kind of upper-level notary. Our ecclesiastical structure sort of branches off at this point, or even slightly above this point in some cases, between cathedrals and parish churches under the bishop and abbeys and monasteries headed by abbots, who sometimes answered to the local bishop, but sometimes had special privileges that made the abbot equal to and independent from the bishop. Many a monastic chronicle features extended conflicts between abbots and bishops over who has ultimate control of an abbey and its property and its residence. Below the abbot in a monastery or abbey, you have a more precise and regular set of officers than in a bishop's court, partly because the Rule of St. Benedict and most later rules lay out exactly what roles should be filled in a monastery. First of these, serving a kind of vice president role, is the prior or prioress, the abbot or abbess's chief deputy. Sometimes the prior will have their own deputy, a sub-prior. Again, these are essentially your monastery's executive class. Below these, you have a set of obedientiaries, who function a little more like department heads. There are a variety of these, but some of the most common appearing in chronicles are the cellarer, who is chiefly responsible for managing the monastery's food supply and storage, and sometimes had broader resource management duties. The sacrist was responsible for maintaining the abbey church and its liturgical resources, while the cantor or precentor oversaw worship itself and the celebration of the hours. An armarius was responsible for providing books and reading materials, as well as provisioning and managing the scriptorium, if there was one. An infirmarian tends to the sick and administers routine bloodlettings. An almoner supervises the distribution of goods to the poor. A guest master tends to guests of the monastery, and a novice master trained the novitiate monks. And that's to name just a few. Under the cellarer, there could be several other monks with distinct titles performing different functions related to dining services. But we've covered a lot of the bases for monks who typically come on stage in the texts we read. The big area we haven't touched on is the mendicant orders, the friars who don't live together in a monastery, but who also had their own hierarchies. But that topic we will save for a future occasion. So, let's shift to our text. In this selection, we do have a little error by our translator, the prolific editor and translator of medieval British historical documents, Joseph Stevenson. In addition to making this translation of the Melrose Chronicle, Stevenson had, a couple of decades earlier, edited the Latin text of the Chronicle. But even someone very familiar with the text they're working with can make a mistake. And here, in the entry for the year 1212, Stevenson writes that Prince Alexander of Scotland was knighted by the King of England in, quote, the 19th year of his age, end quote. That might have passed me by without notice if we weren't told a few years on that Alexander was crowned, quote, in the 17th year of his age, end quote. I was all set to take our chronicler to task for magically de-aging Alexander from 19 to 17, but when I checked Stevenson's edition of the Latin, the Roman numeral for Alexander's knighthood in 1212 is XIIII, not 19, but 14, which does fit the chronology. So Stevenson, as translator, simply misread the numeral or maybe misread his own handwriting in a draft of his translation, but regardless, it is a translator's error and not a scribe's error. And somehow Stevenson didn't notice the discrepancy in Alexander's ages when proofing his text. But given the sheer volume of editions and translations Stevenson put out in the mid-1800s, it's maybe not too surprising that some of the proofing was a bit rushed. I don't point this out to shame Stevenson. Partly, it's just to explain why there's a change in what I'm about to read compared to Stevenson's original, because I have fixed the error in what I'm about to read. And also, I just want to highlight that while our scribe was not at fault in this instance, even modern editors have made the same kinds of mistakes that medieval chroniclers and copyists made, and maybe we need to cut everybody a little bit of slack. And with that, let's turn to the Melrose Chronicle for the years 1212 through 1214. Thank you. Anno Domini 1212. A general decree went out from Pope Innocent throughout all the Christian world that, putting aside any excuse, all the pastors of the churches should assemble at Rome upon a fixed day, that is to say, upon the Calends of November, 1215, for the purpose of there celebrating a general council. Exception, however, was made in favor of a few who, by common consent, should remain in each country for the cure of souls. In the meantime, the bishops should, with all carefulness, preach the word of life, strengthen those who are weak in the faith, and further, should sign them with the sign of the sacred cross, in aid of the Holy Land of Promise, which, at that time, was being treated infamously and disgracefully by the Saracens. Many were the great lights which were sent a latera from the Pope. Doctors of most holy conversation and of learning the most refined came into every region of the world. Of these, two were sent hither, one into England and the other into France. The former of these was Master Stephen de Langton, consecrated Archbishop of Canterbury. He who was dispatched into France was Master Robert de Curzon, Presbyter and Cardinal of the Apostolic See, who was appointed legate and arbitrator for the whole of that kingdom. By the example of their holy conversation and by the ministry of their Catholic preaching, it was intended that they should illuminate both realms. By the advice of the aforesaid Master Robert, the King of France expelled from his cities all public usurers and common prostitutes and all others who held our holy religion in contempt. Alexander, son of William, the King of the Scots, went to London and received the order of knighthood from the King of England upon the 8th of the Ides of March, at the Latera Jerusalem, being then in the 14th year of his age. Having thus been honorably knighted, he returned home with the approbation and congratulations of both realms. At this time there came forth in England a man of surprising boldness and abstinence, Peter by name, who, declaring future events, I do not know by what spirit he was inspired, was in the habit of rebuking the King of England from day to day for his cruelty towards the church, and told him loudly and to his face that before long he would lose the honor of the kingdom and even the name of a king. This, in fact, came to pass, for the greater part ere long, as the succession of our history will make manifest. Anno Domini 1213. Reinald, Bishop of Ross, formerly a monk of Melrose, died on the day of St. Lucy. After his death, Master Andrew de Moray was elected, but he, refusing to be made a bishop, humbly resigned the honor of so great a dignity, having first obtained the Pope's permission to do so. In his stead, Robert, the chaplain of William, King of Scots, was appointed. Adam, abbot of Melrose, was elected to the cure of the bishopric of Caithness on the nones of August. Ernold, abbot of Citeaux, was elected and consecrated Archbishop of Narbonne by diligently preaching the word of life, by confirming the faith of Christ, and by persecution, he succeeded in destroying the sect of the Albigenses. His successor was Ernold, abbot de Font Johannes. Vito, abbot of Clairvaux, exhausted by the long-continued strictness of the order, which pressed heavily upon his old age, resigned to God and the order the seal and superiority of the establishment, which he could no longer sustain. A few days after this, he departed from this world in the ripeness of a venerable old age, and was succeeded by Conrad, abbot of Villiacum of Brabant. Adam, abbot of Newbottle, in the beauty of humility, resigned his office, and was succeeded by Alan, subprior of Melrose. William de Montibus, the chancellor of the Church of Lincoln, died after Easter, a man of pious memory. In the next year, when Christian rites were restored to England, his body was translated into the Church of Lincoln, and there buried with the honor which was its due. Anno Domini 1214. The forenamed Adam, abbot of Melrose, was consecrated Bishop of Caithness by William Malvoisin, Bishop of St. Andrews, on the day of St. Mamertus the Bishop, in the month of May, and on the Ides of May he was succeeded by Hugh de Clipston, a monk of the same house. William, King of Scotland, of holy memory, going the way of all flesh, departed to the Lord by a happy death in the 49th year of his reign, in the 72nd year of his age, on the 2nd of the nones of December, leaving his kingdom in a state of profound peace. His son Alexander, being now in the 17th year of his age, attended by a vast concourse of the nobility, proceeded to Scone, and there, according to the royal custom and with the usual solemnities, he assumed the government of the realm of Scotland upon the 8th of the Ides of December, in equal honor and peace. William, the cellarer of Melrose, was elected abbot of Glenluce. The church of St. Mary of Hoyk was dedicated by Adam, bishop of Caithness, upon the 4th of the Calends of June. The abbot of Citeaux arrived in England for the purpose of his visitation. John, bishop of Dunkeld, of pious memory, died upon the Nones of October, after whom Hugh, the clerk de Sigillo, was elected. Alan, abbot of Newbottle, returned to his own house with humble devotion and resigned the cure of its administration upon the 8th of the Calends of June in the chapter. Richard, the cellarer of the same house, succeeded him. Stephen, Archbishop of Canterbury, came into England between Easter and Whitsunday, while all rejoiced and said, "Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord." The interdict ceased throughout England about the Calends of July. One of the Pope's clerks, named Pandolf, was sent into England to soften the king's heart and persuade him to make condign satisfaction. He returned to Rome, having made some progress towards a reconciliation, though it had not been fully completed. On his return, another personage of considerable repute was dispatched. His name was Nicholas, a Cistercian monk, the chief penitentiary of the Apostolic See. The object of his mission was this, that by his legatine authority he should confirm the peace of which the terms had already been agreed upon, and, after having received from the king the satisfaction which was due, he should absolve him from the bond of the anathema. But while this was in progress, Philip, King of France, acting doubtlessly by divine influence, boldly rose against the King of England and marched with a large army to the coast opposite his realms. Moreover, that simple prophet Peter, whom we have already mentioned, redoubled his rebukes in the very face of the king and constantly announced that he would be deprived of his royal dignity, and he remarked to him that the son of a certain good woman would reign after him, meaning thereby, as we understand it, that he would be succeeded by Philip, the son of Holy Mother Church. Terrified, therefore, by these manifold alarms, when the cardinal arrived, he did his homage to God and the Holy Mother Church of Rome and to the Pope, and with surprising meekness he resigned into the hands of the legate the perpetual subjection of his realm. And as a testimony of this, his subjection and homage, not only he, but also the nobility of his land, promised, by oath upon the holy shrines, that he and all his heirs would pay a yearly tribute of 1,000 marks, that is to say, 700 for England and 300 for Ireland, out of their own resources, to God and the Pope and all his successors. The oath contained this addition, that he would make full restitution of everything which he had extorted from the churches and from ecclesiastical persons from the period when his land had first been laid under interdict, and that henceforth he would hold his land from the Lord Pope as from a supreme king. All these things the king very readily promised to do, and he placed the crown of his kingdom under the feet of the legate. Blessed be God, the strong and the powerful over all, who knoweth, according to his good pleasure, how to bow under himself the necks of the proud, and how to call to repentance the hearts of the stubborn ones. Yet, not even now understanding that he had forfeited the kingly name and lost his former honor, John commanded that this Peter, whom we have more than once mentioned, should be put to a cruel death, an act which he afterwards most bitterly repented, as we shall have occasion to show presently. A battle was fought in Flanders between Tournai and the Bridge of Bouvines, between Philip, King of France, and Otho, who had formerly been Emperor of Germany, upon the Sunday next after the Feast of St. James, which this year fell upon the 6th of the Calends of August. It appears from the written account sent by H., Abbot of Ursa Campum, to Arnold, Abbot of Citeaux, that in this fight there were captured, on the side of Otho, the Earl of Flanders, the Earl of Boulogne, the Earl of Salisbury, the Earl of Tinnebrock, and the Earl Pelosius. Many barons of Flanders and Germany and their sons, as well as many of the more illustrious and braver of the knights who took part in the battle, were also made prisoners, whom this abbot enumerated by name to the extent of nearly 70. On Otho's side were 30,000 horsemen and 200,000 foot soldiers. The account of the knights who were captured was 120. 70 were killed. Of the foot soldiers, 3,000 times 3,000 were slain. On the side of the French, only 3 knights fell. It is true that the King of France was thrown off his horse and fell into the midst of the fiercest of his enemies, who thirsted for nothing more than his blood, but by God's mercy, by the intercession with God of the Cistercian order, as he afterwards admitted, and by the courage of his own soldiers, some of whom allowed themselves to be killed over his body, he remounted his horse and escaped in safety. We cannot pass unnoticed that the Earl of Boulogne, whose rebellion was the cause of the whole war, when he threw himself on the ground before the King of France and entreated his forgiveness, observed that he had done no wrong to that sovereign, whereupon the king indignantly reminded him of all the benefits which he had conferred upon him and how ungratefully he had always repaid his kindness, and at last broke out in these words, "Be silent, for by the bones of St. James I will cause your eyes to be plucked out, and be assured of this, that as long as I am alive you shall never come forth from your prison." Moreover, he bound the keepers with an oath that they would not release the earl from prison, save only into his own hands, and that they would pay no attention either to his message or his letters. And lastly, he caused 2 strong and massive chains to be fixed in the trunk of a tree, bound to which the earl became the warden of Peronne, much against his own inclination. So, that brings us to the end of the year 1214 in the Melrose Chronicle. If you'd like to hear what happens next, you can go back to our episode 36 concerning the depredations of King John, which starts directly after today's selection with the Melrose Chronicle entry for 1215, as John faces the political aftermath of the rather humiliating resolution of the interdict and the battle that ended the Chronicle's narrative of 1214. Our chronicler frames the Battle of Bouvines as principally between King Philip II of France and the Holy Roman Emperor Otho, or Otto IV. But the army led by Otto was a coalition force pressing mostly English and Flemish territorial claims, and King John of England is sitting just behind the scenes, orchestrating much of the campaign. His goal was to win back lands that Philip had taken over, restoring his family holdings, which had included, of course, not just England, but Normandy. The decisive defeat of the coalition forces by the French left John politically weakened in England and created the circumstances where his barons could compel him to sign Magna Carta. It also ended Otto's career as Holy Roman Emperor, and in the longer term began the European power shift away from the German emperors and to the kings of France. The battle also gives us a chance to examine the reliability of numbers in medieval chronicles. The Melrose Chronicler, in presenting the enormity of the conflict, claims that Otto's forces numbered 30,000 horsemen and 200,000 foot soldiers. Well, modern historians have worked out that in reality, Otto had about 1,500 knights and 7,500 infantry for a total of about 9,000 troops. Now, interestingly, our chronicler's casualty numbers for the knights aren't too far off. He writes that 120 of Otto's knights were captured and 70 killed, and only 3 French knights fell. The modern figures are 2 French knights killed, and about 125 coalition knights and nobles taken prisoner, and 169 of their knights killed. Infantry losses for the coalition aren't known with any specificity, other than that they were heavy, but clearly, the figure had to be far fewer than 3,000 times 3,000, as our chronicler writes, since that figure would be about 8% of the total population of Europe in 1214. And just to give the obvious answer to the obvious question, why the huge discrepancy in accuracy between knightly casualties and infantry ones? Well, because in the mind of a medieval monastic chronicler, the knights who died or were captured were actual people whose fates would have been known and documented, whereas the foot soldiers are a faceless mob, and who cares? I've said it before, but medieval chroniclers' approach to battle figures always reminds me of the concept in Richard Adams' Watership Down that the rabbit characters of the book just can't cognitively process numbers beyond four, so any quantity greater than four is rare or countless, be it 5 or 50 or 5,000. With medieval descriptions of battles, and this is also pretty true for classical and biblical descriptions as well, it likewise seems as though any figure beyond, say, 1,000 just turns into a gajillion, rare, in the form of any arbitrary big number. Or not arbitrary, there's usually some symbolic resonance. Things come in threes, fives, sevens, nines, the usual suspects. Why write that just a lot of nameless infantry were slain when you can go with the infinitely more poetic 3,000 times 3,000? A figure of a different kind in our selection also could use some illumination. This figure is not a number, but a personality. Peter the Prophet, also known as Peter of Wakefield or Peter of Pontefract. We don't know much about him beyond what is recounted in this story. Other chroniclers also tell this story with added details, but Peter's collision course with King John is the only reason he makes it into recorded history at all. We are told he was a hermit. Touching back on the ecclesiastical positions we surveyed earlier, here we have a person most likely operating outside of all of those. Sometimes people identified as hermits lived in a loose monastic community with varying degrees of institutional structure, such as the hermit we met in episode 98 concerning the life of Elgar the Hermit and divine dinner delivery. Sometimes hermits might be anchorites who are actual monastics attached to an abbey or a church, but they could also be unaffiliated loners following their own spiritual call. For some, that's just to lead a simple life of peaceful contemplation. For others, it's an ascetic retreat from society that might be a private way to atone for a sinful past. And for some, as appears to be the case with Peter, they take on the life of a hermit as a result of a visionary spiritual experience. Maybe. Certainly, Peter had a reputation for having foreknowledge of things yet to come. That is attested by the chronicler's writing closest to the event. But that's pretty much all the background they supply for Peter. He was a hermit with a local reputation as a wise man who said prophetic things and attracted the attention of King John when he started promulgating a prediction of the end of John's reign. About 100 years later, Ranulf Higdon wrote about Peter and King John in his massive universal history, The Polychronicon, and he includes more detail about Peter's life, which has the basic elements of a sharply abridged saint's life. It's hard to say whether Ranulf is preserving real historic details that previous authors had omitted, or if he's incorporating a legendary tradition that grew around Peter afterward that may not have much footing in historical reality. But that needn't stop us from hearing it. Here is Ranulf Higdon's account of Peter of Wakefield, here called Piers of Pontefract, as translated into Middle English in the late 1300s by John Trevisa, and then lightly modernized by me. About that time, King John made to be hanged and drawn a holy man called Piers of Pontefract, for he had warned him of many mishaps that should befall him for his cruelness and for his fornication. Also, for he had warned him that he should reign but 14 years, and he reigned almost 18 years, but he knew not that in doing that he reigned freely but 14 years, but he reigned 3 years not freely, for those 3 years he was tributary to the Pope. Christ appeared to this Piers twice at York and once at Pontefract in the likeness of a child between the priest's hands, and breathed on him, or inspired him, and said thrice, "Peace, peace, peace," and taught him many things that he told afterward to bishops and people that were of evil life. Also one time he lay 3 days and 3 nights as if he were in a swooning, and was ravished, or rapt, and saw the joys and pains of good men and of evil. So, Ranulf Higden helps expand our picture of Peter's origins. Other chroniclers give us a more vivid account of just how he met his end than the Melrose Chronicle does. Melrose just says that the king put him to, quote, a cruel death, end quote. Roger of Wendover tells us just what that cruelty entailed. Here's what he writes in his Flores Historiarum, or Flowers of History, likely composed only a decade or so after the event, if that. The day of our Lord's ascension on the morrow was looked for with mistrust, not only by the king, but by all others, as well absent as present, on account of the assertions of Peter the Hermit, who, as was stated before, had prophesied to John that he would not be a king on Ascension Day or afterwards. But after he had passed the prefixed day and continued safe and in health, the king ordered the aforesaid Peter, who was detained a prisoner in Corfe Castle, to be tied to the horse's tail at the town of Wareham, dragged through the streets of the town, and afterwards hung on a gibbet, together with his son. To many, it did not seem that he deserved to be punished by such a cruel death for declaring the truth, for if the circumstance stated above to have happened be thoroughly considered, it will be proved that he did not tell a falsehood. Roger's account is one of the only ones that mentions that Peter of Wakefield had a son, one presumably complicit in spreading the royal prophecy, which cracks the door just a teensy bit more on Peter's largely mysterious life. On the subject of a different kind of outrage, though still a form of terrorism, I had occasion, when working on these last two episodes, to try to look up information in the manuscript of the Melrose Chronicle. Unfortunately, I was unable to do so because the British Library's online collection of digitized manuscripts is still unavailable after the cyber attack that hit the library nearly a year ago, which is a long time in the 21st century, and my heart goes out to all the scholars and students over the past year whose work has been severely curtailed by the loss of that amazing resource. For me, it's an inconvenience. For others, it could sideline a whole research project or dissertation or monograph. But perhaps it does give us 21st century scholars a tiny sliver of the experience of the early medieval people who lost monastic libraries to Viking raids, and reminds us that even in our comfortable modern offices and living rooms, we aren't immune to this new form of pillaging. Fortunately, the British Library posted back in May that they were anticipating having the digitized manuscripts back up and accessible by September of this year. As of this writing, they're still down, but the month isn't over. And on the subject of access, here's our riddle for this episode. Great deeds with little strength I do, I close the open, ope the closed for you. I keep the master's house, the master keeps me too. This is one of the riddles of Symphosius, and the answer, the thing that both opens and closes, is clavis, a key. And speaking of keys, when cardinals are summoned to elect a new pope, that is a conclave, literally Latin for with, con, a key, clavis. It originally meant any chamber that could be locked, but became associated specifically with the room in which the cardinals gathered to elect a pope, and from the room, the gathering itself took on the name conclave, and then that specific usage broadened to refer to all sorts of other private gatherings, though usually with some notion of getting official business done. A 1685 book by George Meryton, entitled Nomenclatura Clericalis, or The Young Clerk's Vocabulary in English and Latin, a wonderful resource I just recently came across while trying to look up Clericus de Sigillo, offers another definition for conclavia. Quote, any chambers under one key, end quote. So this harkens back to conclave as the room rather than the assembly, but here it's not just a room, but any set of rooms behind one locked entry. Perhaps a bit like the early modern version of an office suite. Or indeed, it's almost certainly referring to setups like the chambers of a group of barristers, which are sort of the evolutionary ancestor of the co-working spaces that we have today. And with that, we have reached the end of this episode. If you'd like to get more information, including bibliographic references for the featured texts and sources, you can find all of that at our website, medievaldeathtrip.com, and you can also email me there to patrick@medievaldeathtrip.com. And rather than reeling off an increasingly cumbersome roster of social media accounts, you can find links to all of those also at our website or via your typical search engines. We're present on Instagram, Blue Sky, and Mastodon, and who knows what else, as social media seems to continue into its fragmentation era. You can also help support the show through Patreon. $1 a month, or equivalent, gets you access to bonus content, including an upcoming appendix to this very episode featuring some of the actual canons of the Fourth Lateran Council. You can find us there at patreon.com/mdtpodcast. I want to thank all of our patrons for their generosity. You really do help keep this show going. So, until next time, maybe hold your prophetic revelations close to the vest if you value your neck, and thanks for listening.